Spearheading U.S. campaign to halt the flow of money to terrorists. He served as the Treasury's chief legal advisor and senior policy advisor to the Secretary. He regularly testified before Congress and had direct oversight over its economic sanctions program, foreign financial crime investigations, and the USA Patriot Act regulatory responsibilities. Prior to the current appointment, he practiced law for 24 years with the firm of Williams & Connolly in Washington, D.C., where he served as trial counsel. Mr. Althauser has a bachelor's degree from Wesleyan, an MBA from Harvard, and a JD from the University of Pennsylvania. Substantial credentials. Please join me, my friends, in giving a warm welcome to David Althauser.
Thank you, Irwin. Irwin's correct. We are now fast friends. It may be because I've agreed to have to do my taxes this year. I also want to thank Amy Shargell. Actually, Amy and I have not seen much of each other, but we went to law school. Or actually, I went to law school with her husband, and that's the connection that brings me here. And my one observation is that Amy has gotten younger and I've gotten older, but it's good to be here. I was downtown earlier this morning actually talking to some folks at the Wall Street Journal at Liberty Plaza, and of course that particular area of town remains probably the most telling part of the entire globe about the cost of terror, but also about the design that terrorists have on leveraging not only the loss of life, but the leveraging the loss of life with actually a disproportionate, if not catastrophic, economic impact and loss of commerce. And of course, it's also the most telling witness, I think, today to the pathetic state of our homeland security before the time of that calamity. I am, as Irwin said, I'm only 2 weeks out of the Treasury Department. And after the visit downtown, I had, again, one of these moments wondering why I had left the business and the office, and was reminded of a Lily Tomlin line, which I'll share with you, which is that when we were all young, we always wished that we'd be somebody someday, and now that we're older, we only wish we'd been a little more specific about it. Now, the reason it's such a good line is that it's just plain human to have some regret about some of the forks you've taken on the road. I want to tell you, in the years at Treasury, there was absolutely no doubt. And it might have been because it was a very peculiar time to be the general counsel of the Department of Treasury. If you think about it, we actually fought four wars during my three-year tenure. The first is Afghanistan, the state sponsor of terror through the Taliban. The second is, of course, Iraq, which I'll speak about a little bit more later. The third is what I think most of you hear about, which is the wider global war on terrorism, which surfaces with mayhem and homicide not only in New York City, but in Bali and in Istanbul and in Morocco and in Nairobi and in Moscow and in Chechnya and in Riyadh with too much regularity. Also with real threats to the subways of London in a trial that's about to go forward in the Old Bailey, and of course continually in Manila and the Philippines. Truly a war that is global in scope and respects no border. There is a fourth conflict actually that does not directly involve U.S. troops, but is also very present in virtually everything that we've done at Treasury with regard to money flows. And that is what I will call the proxy war in which we're involved in, which is the long conflict in Israel and Palestine today. Oddly enough, the one common strain in all four of these campaigns or high-profile theaters of conflict has been the central role that money has played. It struck me as a surprise when I went into the government, but it's logical. And the reason it's logical is that the money fuels each of these campaigns, and it's turned out as we got more sophisticated in terms of the forensics of fighting these kinds of very unorthodox wars, that money was also the best way to diminish the threat, if not extinguish the threat of another calamity and more warfare. Iraq, which I mentioned, is of course very much on our minds. We lost two more sons and brothers yesterday in Mosul. Those folks died, in my judgment, unfortunately. because of a growing and unholy alliance between Al-Qaeda, Baptist outliers, and literally all manner and nature of people intent on demonstrating the limits of our power through contesting our presence in Iraq. And I mean the limits of our power. That's to be distinguished from an affirmative goal, for example, of trying to reestablish the ancient caliphate. This is a contest where people would like to demonstrate our impotence. There is, in fact, in my judgment, some reason to believe that to the extent that there is a grain to terror, and that can be overstated, and surely since we can't start the war on terrorism, and in particular the war on financial terrorism, a lot of what they do has become balkanized because it's easier for us to attack them as a central nervous system. I lost that train of thought. Let me come back to that. This particular alliance in Iraq represents a decision, in my judgment. And I'm expressing opinion here, not fact, so don't get too excited. But it's an opinion, which is informed opinion, represents a judgment that they would rather not attack us again on our own soil in the U.S. because it would just continue to generate an intensity of opposition which they don't want to face. I think the thinking enemies of freedom and liberty today want to demonstrate the limits of our power and have chosen the soft areas and targets. Iraq right now is the internationalized magnet to do so. You may think that Iraq is an odd place to start. It's not. By the way, if you haven't read Newsweek this week, I recommend it to you. There's an extraordinary, extraordinary interview of a meeting of Al-Qaeda lieutenants and Taliban lieutenants where they actually discussed the allocation of financial resources and the reallocation of the warriors in Afghanistan to Iraq. It's a chilling portrait of the deliberateness and the consciousness with which the global terrorist network tries to work its ill. The most telling part about that particular article is actually the thesis for this talk, which is at the end of the article, one of the senior members who attended the meeting is alleged to have said, essentially, we cannot do the devil's work without financial support from abroad. That's what I want to talk to you about. But I want to start perhaps in odd place. I want to return back to Iraq because it's part of what I think is an indictment of the casualness with which we approach the financial borders and issues of financial integrity before 9/11. Think back to Desert Storm in 1990. We had a great success in terms of ousting Hussein from Kuwait and imposing upon him through UN sanctions, the most far-reaching international comprehensive sanctions ever imposed, the three forms, compelled inspections for weapons, which ended in 1997, something that we all regret, but something that he acted with impunity to stop. The second is a review of their borders, that is, actual UN inspectors at their borders to make sure prohibited goods did not go in there. And most importantly, a far-reaching economic sanctions program. All three of these were intended to make sure that Iraq could never be a threat. And when they started in place, they were enormously successful. In fact, they were crushing, and people started to die. People started to starve. And so the world community got together and said, we had to be a little smarter about the kind of sanctions, economic sanctions program that we were imposing on Iraq. And came up with the now famous or infamous UN Oil for Food program. Now, the Oil for Food program, if you collapse it, is simply a barter program. It permitted Hussein to take oil out of the ground and to barter that oil for humanitarian goods and services. It was intended to be structured so that there would be no dollars attached to it, only goods and services delivered. In one sense, it is the UN's finest hour. Yeah, more than $10 billion of humanitarian care and food and services were delivered through more than 25,000 different distribution centers throughout Iraq. It became a staple of much of their civilian society. In fact, when we went into Iraq, there were really four currencies that were very relevant. One was the Saddam dinar, the other was the Swiss dinar, which characterized much of the Kurdish north. The third were U.S. dollars packed in people's mattresses. And the fourth, by testimony of many of them, the most valuable, was the U.N. food rationing card, which was traded regularly for things other than U.N. food. But this was an enormously successful humanitarian program. But it was designed not by businessmen, but by international bureaucrats. And it was easily gamed by Hussein, and he literally made it a holiday for graft. And as widely reported through kickbacks and schemes and front companies, he integrated himself as an intermediary effectively in the UN Oil for Food program and skimmed north of $6 billion out of that program. This was openly known to much of the world community, and they just shrugged their shoulders. It was so openly known that by 1999 he realized he could act with impunity. So he started literally selling oil for money outside of the UN Oil for Food program. He built a pipeline to Syria. He paved a road to Turkey. And if you take a look at satellite photographs, you could see hundreds of tanker trucks on every day of the week delivering unsanctioned illegal oil into Turkey. And still the world did virtually nothing about it. And trade flourished with Jordan. And year in and year out, the United States, as most of the world, aware that this was happening, would waive the kind of sanctions that would bar foreign aid to these countries for violating the UN sanctions program, perhaps for various larger geopolitical reasons. But the thing that haunts us about the way that the economic sanctions program was not, in fact, ever truly enforced after the UN Oil for Food program was put into place, in my judgment, the thing that haunts us is he took the money, the illicit money, and while he wasted an awful lot of it on profligacy, he took it and bought prohibited goods, including the wherewithal to arm himself. Now, you can miss a great deal of discord about whether the wherewithal to arm himself is conventional or reflected an ambition to develop unconventional and wholly unacceptable and obscene weaponry. But whether or not we can resolve that today, put that aside, it's clear he bought prohibited goods and services, including those that led us to a realistic conclusion that there was a threat from Iraq that had to be dealt with. And of course, like I said, it haunts us today because two of our kids were killed in Mosul yesterday. It also continues to haunt us because a great deal of money has not been found. And that money is in part fueling the insurgency that's going on in Iraq. The insurgency that I characterized earlier for you is really in part an international jihad, an avenue, a venue where they hope to demonstrate the limits of U.S. power. Now, to them, that's important, because if you think about it, the whole DNA of war has changed. I wish I could say that was my phrase. It's not a phrase. It's David, and I always mispronounce his name, Reif or Rife, David's phrase, but I heard he did a lecture several weeks ago at American University. The rules of war have changed. No sane opponent of our ideology is going to face us on a military battlefield again. It was demonstrated as far back as 1990 in Desert Storm that we have such a disproportionate amount of high-tech military power that to actually challenge the United States on a conventional battlefield is to invite your own defeat. It doesn't mean the end of war, however. It means they have to recede to the shadows, and they have receded to the shadows, and that's otherwise known as the War of Terror. And in the War of Terror, being unbelievably unorthodox and something we haven't seen before, we face, among other things, a foe that cannot be deterred, so deterrence should not be part of our calculus, with one exception, which is the finance. I'll come back to that. We don't face an army. We don't face people with any legitimate or real intent on geographic conquest. Rather, they have an intent of demonstrating through their actions the limits of our power, and presumably the limits of our commerce as well. Back to the shadows. You can't shoot shadows. Military power cannot win the war on terror. You have to take a step back and think about bringing all elements of national power to bear on this. And that's why you have the anomaly of the General Counsel of the Department of Treasury being deeply involved in actually commanding literally a troop or a corps of people from law enforcement people to intelligence people to military people to diplomatic people and to the financial people who work for us at Treasury and in the other financial-related departments of government. I mentioned the casualness with which I think led to the Iraq War. On 9/11, I was in Cambridge, England, at an international conference on money laundering, and although it was largely a sober group of people with a lot of high credentials, attorneys generals and chief justices and the head of Interpol and the like, notwithstanding the sobriety of these people generally, there was a lot of backslapping because we really had gotten pretty sophisticated in dealing with commercial money laundering, in predictive computer models, in the topography of crime, in indictments and in confiscations, and there was an awful lot to be thankful for. What happened, of course, is that we all witnessed in Cambridge at Jesus College what you witnessed presumably here in New York, which was the disintegration of the Twin Towers, the very temple of commerce. And we witnessed it like you over and over again that evening when it was that played and played and played. And there was an awful pall in the audience, more than 300 people, a very large room, a gigantic screen. And the pall, of course, reflected what you all felt in your living rooms, which was the awfulness of it. But it also reflected, in my judgment, and I'm projecting here a little bit, it reflected the professional judgment that the people in the world community who were responsible for policing the financial borders and being true gatekeepers of civilian society knew they'd failed. They were there at Jesus College, and this was something wholly unanticipated and something for which no resource had ever been designed. And they felt like literally they had been looking at the world through the wrong end of the telescope. Now, the rest of them were stuck, but I was flown home on a military transport the next day. I was flown home for a reason. The President of the United States and the Secretary of Treasury recognized immediately this was a very unorthodox war and that money would play a very critical role in it. That if you could stop the money, you could substantially diminish the invention of design, the establishment of cells, training, recruiting, transit, the whole enterprise of terror. And I was put to work, actually, with a group of people, terrific people, to try to build up that fourth arm of a military assault on terror. Now, the task actually came to me with considerable irony. I'd gone into the government when Paul O'Neill said, help me take good money, that is foreign aid, and put it to good account. And we had some very distinct ideas. We were going to put a well in every village in West Africa. We were going to take a step back from grandiloquent master plans, which have a particular narcotic in Washington, and try to do it village by village. Now I found myself with the reverse distorted mirror image of the assignment. It wasn't applying good money to good purpose. It was trying to stop bad money intended for killing purpose. But it was very much for a very good cause and has been. And that goes back to what I said about the DNA of war has changed. Nothing, in my judgment, and you can get carried away with the your own advocacy, particularly if you've been at this 24/7 for 3 years, nothing in the war on terror is more promising in giving us real results than stopping the source of the funding. Stopping the source of the funding. And I'll give you four or five reasons why I think that. The first is, this is doable. This is doable. I can tell you, as I said publicly before, that if you combine all the elements of the campaign, which I'm glad and I'm happy to outline for you in a second, you can have real impact. The cash flow to Al-Qaeda has decreased by two-thirds, as best as we can determine. Now, that leaves one-third too much, and one-third is too much. Can bring great calamity around the globe and is doing so today. But the actual cash flow has been diminished substantially. So the task is doable. Second, it provides infinite leverage or near infinite leverage on stopping misadventure. Think of this. Which task would you rather have if you worked for the government? Trying to identify a dozen cells with a dozen ideas of designs of terror because they have money in their pocket, which is the right end of the production cycle or pipeline, or stopping the capitalization of that enterprise, stopping the money at the source, And if we can stop the money at the source, all invention of terror will be muted. And we can effectively address dozens upon dozens of as yet undreamt of acts of mayhem. The third is, nothing has more integrity in the war on terror than money. Virtually all the evidence that we gather is highly suspect in this war. It comes from treachery and deceit and bribery and interrogation and in some instances downright torture. And that comes at a cost. You have to discount the quality of what you're hearing. But the financial records don't lie. If you can get a hold of the financial records, they are diaries, literally diaries of terrorist planning. So when we see Sheikh Mohammed, a very key member of the Al-Qaeda terrorist cell, the body possession of this man and subjecting him to interrogation is invaluable to the fight against terror. But of equal weight was the seizure of his computer and the financial records that were reflected in his computers. And the same could be true of everyone of a substantial nature in the network that we've seized around the globe, either we or our allies have seized around the globe. The record keeping is a map to design. And, of course, it doesn't lie. Let me give you two elliptical examples of the utility of financial information. 14 people, and I think I alluded to this earlier, 14 people, well, you've got to tell me when my timing's tight, 14 people are about to stand trial in the Old Bailey for conspiracy to bring ricin into the London subway stations. Ricin is made out of castor oil. If made right, it's 30 times more potent than VX gas. It will kill a lot of people, and it's easy to make. And it's in their textbook of how to create terror. We had a piece of intelligence, the world community has a piece of intelligence that said something was afoot in London and it involved ricin. And then we had a number of names, all of which were partial. Piecing together financial records obtained from relevant authorities, we tossed in the names of people. Let's say David, Keith, Carl, in some cases, last name, Hock, as in Hochberg. We tossed these into the basket of information of financial transactions that might be occurring somewhere relevant. And all of a sudden, we started getting linkages. You can have computer programs that do. And the linkages brought us to 14 names of people in 14 locations. And more importantly, the linkages demonstrate who they were dealing with, and what supplies they were buying, and where they were supplying the supplies, and what cross-border financial transactions they were engaged in. And sure enough, it led to the indictment and the capture of these people, and the end of a plot to kill hundreds, if not thousands, of people in London. So stopping the money trail has this dual dividend, the double dividend of not only bankrupting them and taking away their capital, but also alerting us to and letting us follow through to the end potential calamities that are being planned. A fourth point, and a very important point, I think I also alluded to this earlier. The guy who straps a bomb on his back is implacable. He's the undeterrable foe. He's beyond redemption. There's virtually nothing we can do in law enforcement except try to prevent him. He won't be deterred by the threat of going to jail for the rest of his life. But his banker is a coward. His banker has a lot to lose. And his banker loves his anonymity. And if we can out his banker, and banker I'm using in a generic sense, if we can out his banker, you can end the mayhem, or at least diminish it substantially. So we adopted some tools with that strategic observation in mind. And the tools, I think, are very familiar to you. At 50,000 feet, we changed literally the vocabulary and the agenda of priorities for international security. Terrorist financing was unknown at the G10, the G7, the G8, the G20, the World Bank, the IMF, APEC, everywhere. It was unknown. It wasn't in the vocabulary until after 9/11. We brought it up as a chief main agenda item everywhere. And very quickly, as the terror spread, to Moscow and to Bali and to the Philippines and to the threat in London, it became plain and clear to the commercial and the financial community that what was being done is a great irony, and that is that the terrorist networks were intent upon using commerce, spiriting money across the borderless financial world, using commerce to destroy commerce, and to visit not only the death of 3,000 people downtown in New York in a single event, but $1 trillion of capital loss, and another $1 trillion of a new industry called security, and to have an enormous leveraging effect. Anyway, we changed the vocabulary. We also changed the legal architecture. It wasn't enough to talk about this around the table of the G10. We needed laws, and the UN assisted us with 1373, and we now have laws in place in 80, 90, or 100 countries that criminalize terrorism, terrorist financing. That's an important thing. It wasn't a principle before. Third, we also changed the standards of conduct. We wrote an executive order, actually I wrote it, which essentially gives the president the power to freeze the assets not only of entities through which terrorist money passes, but of its shareholders, its officers, and directors under a strict liability standard. Now, we have seldom exercised that power, but the threat of it is more important than the execution of it, and it's permitted us insight and access to books and records around the world when we threatened it. In other words, negligence is not a defense. You've got to know your customer, and you've got to know what the hell is going on in your institution. Third, we internationalized it. I spoke about that before. And fourth, it's not enough to have laws. You've got to build up capacity, particularly in the transitional and developing countries. They can have all the laws enforced, but they lack the dollars and the resources and the people sophistication to enforce those laws, particularly for the forensic sciences of financial accounting and the like, following the money. And the U.S. has a very, very large program doing that around the world today. There has been real material impact. We know this directly from the people that we detain in Guantanamo, the people we've detained elsewhere, and from books and records, and from other intelligence sources. It's actually been a very successful campaign in reducing the cash flow. By the way, one observation, it's wrong to look at this as a balance sheet exercise. I've said this before, too, so forgive me if you've heard it. A lot of people focus on how many assets have you frozen. That was the beginning, easy, low-hanging dynamic. The more important thing is what in businessmen call the EBITDA analysis. Can you get at the cash flow? And I can tell you the cash flow has been substantially diminished because the bankers, and I'll tell you who the bankers are in a second, the bankers really are the are fearful of the scrutiny and fearful of the involvement. We have many instances where we've heard that those who want to perpetrate further terrorist acts have said, I lack money. And you don't have to believe my own advocacy. Read this week's Newsweek, where a guy actually says, but for foreign financial support, I could not do the devil's work. Who are the bankers? They include rich merchants around the world. They include charities, which have populated the world. It's worth taking a step back on the charities. There has been a virtual explosion of NGOs in the 1990s. In part, it's because there have been many theaters of conflict where there's much hopelessness. In part because the Gulf countries, in particular Saudi Arabia, became very, very rich, as we all know, from oil revenues. Allied with their religious tenet of giving was also the desire to help preserve the faith where threatened, as in ethnic cleansing in Bosnia. And so a great deal of money flowed to the Islamic diaspora throughout the world through NGOs to deliver not only humanitarian services, but a form of militant support for the preservation of the faith. And one of the most challenging tasks about the terrorist financing initiative is distinguishing between financial support intended for fundamentalism and financial support intended for terror, which we can talk about in the Q&A if you want. There are profound structural challenges for us. Most of the world that we're focusing on, that we're most concerned about, try not to use the recorded banking system. They use an informal banking system based on trust called hawala. There are only two ways to deal with hawalas. One is intelligence and penetration. And the third is, and the second is, structural macroeconomic change. That is a reason in their economic climates
where people would go to the recorded banking system rather than to the wallets. I'll give you one example. In the Gulf, there was a country that forbade new immigrants from having a bank account. Most of the new immigrants in most of the Gulf countries are there because they want to earn wages to remit back to their families in India or Pakistan or the like, or the Sudan. Not going into the banking system leaves them with a default mechanism of having to go to Hawalas for the transfer of the money. And so they went to the Hawalas and they learned, one, the transactions cost is probably less than the banking system, and two, these are people who can be trusted. And week in, week out, the money was delivered home. We went to that country and we said, change it all. Change it all. And there was a substantial uptick in recorded banking by foreign immigrants after that. The largest challenge is what I already spoke to, which is the distinction between fundamentalism, financing fundamentalism, and financing terror. What is taught in hundreds, if not thousands, of madrasas and Islamic centers and mosques established around the world is too easily twisted into hate. And people who go out to be apostles of faith are using the kind of incendiary language which is akin to yelling fire in a dark theater. And it's being embraced by kids who have only one symbol of authority, which is this clerical teacher who teaches them that part of their mission is holy jihad. We've got to fight these ideas. If we don't find a way to fight these ideas and the financing of these ideas, we will never prevail in the war on terror, in my judgment. Let me give you one example. I know we're interested in the Middle East in particular, and I've probably spoken about Al-Qaeda too much. I don't want to be Al-Qaeda or Saudi-centric in this discussion. This is a global problem. Al-Manar is a TV station in Beirut. It has about $100 million of yearly budget. It has a half hour to an hour daily program called The Fourth. And the program is devoted to diatribes of anti-American and anti-Israel rhetoric. It also is a program, is a station which solicits funds for essentially institutions associated with Hamas and Hezbollah. We all know that Hamas and Hezbollah are dedicated, among other things, to the destruction of the state of Israel. It's in their charter. Until we get at the propagation of these ideas through stations like Al-Manar, and until we get the propagation of ideas and the funding of both of these, the outreach effort by the Gulf states throughout the United throughout the world, in the establishment of madrasas that teach this extreme, uncompromising, intolerant strain of Islam, we're going to be paying a great burden and a great price. I want to leave you on a bad note. I said structural change has been, and this is the last thing I'll say, structural change is important. I want to relate one measure taken in Saudi Arabia, which is really extraordinary if you think about it. For more than 1,700 years, in the peninsula of Saudi Arabia, long before there was a Saudi Arabia, since the founding of Islam, mosques have collected coin and currency in collection boxes, which are known as zakat. It's a very important part of the faith, and it's a very private transaction. It's what you might call a good secret. It's between you and your God, and it's a way of giving to those in need in your community. Well, we have found zakat in the hands of Al-Qaeda cells and have convinced the Saudis, they didn't need much convincing, they reached it themselves, that this was a threat. And they have banned zakatas, that is cash collection boxes, in the 40,000 mosques that now populate Saudi Arabia. Now that's an extraordinary measure taken. And by the way, don't discount the pennies in the boxes. If there are 40,000 mosques in Saudi Arabia, there are hundreds of thousands of mosques and collection boxes throughout the world. And there are professional aggregators of that money. And cash is easily diverted, and there's very little accounting for it. So if you can stop that source of banking of terror, the diversion of money from those collection boxes, you've done an enormous service to the people. I actually think that the campaign against terrorist financing if executed well, will bring more peace than any army of soldiers, because bullets won't stop these guys. You have to stop them where, if you will, the incubator of all invention of terror is, and that's the money in their pockets. They can't transit, they can't plan, they can't recruit, they can't train, they can't feed, they can't execute, they can't escape without money.
On behalf of the forum, I'd like to thank Mr. Althauser for this very lucid explanation of our country's strategy for fighting terror. We're going to open the field for questions now. I'd like to begin with a very quick one of my own, which is, you mentioned that bankers are cowards, that the people who supply money to terrorists can be deterred. And we've heard assurances from the Saudi government, from the governments of our Arab allies, that they are taking action to close down Islamic charities that fund terrorism. What we don't seem to have seen is trials of charity directors, bankers. I mean, we're not talking about the armed terrorist cells, but trials of the money men in the Arab world who have either deliberately channeled money to terrorists, sent money to Afghanistan, or who have looked the other way while others did so. And I was wondering if you could speak about whether that's a problem.
A couple of points. I'm pleased whenever there's a prosecution, but this is an exercise first about prevention. And this is an important point I want to make. Going abroad with evidence about suspected terrorist activity, I don't ever want to be faced with a criminal law standard for the sufficiency of the evidence. People have to lean forward in the new jurisprudence of terror. They have to lean forward and be prepared to act on less than criminal convincing evidence if we're going to be able to prevent calamity. So I don't look for, in the first instance, building cases to prosecute. Of course, if there is enough evidence, terrific. Second, Saudi Arabia has made enormous strides structurally in addressing the regulatory oversight of its charities, and they're to be commended for it. This ban on zakat is another example of the measures they've taken in terms of systemic change, and it actually should be a model for many countries. Let me give you an example. Under their new regulation, a Saudi charity cannot give money abroad unless that money is deposited into a central bank account and the transfer is supervised by government officials. Now, if you try to do that in America, you'd find yourself in an Article 3 court immediately, and you'd lose. That regulation would be a violation, probably, of the First Amendment. So it's an extraordinary and meaningful step. Having said that, one of the things that has been missing in the Saudi dialogue has been personal accountability. We pressed them with that. And the response has been promising, which is the establishment of this joint investigatory task force in Riyadh now, which includes IRS agents who used to work for me, FBI agents, and their equivalent in the Saudi Interior Ministry. 14 of those folks from Saudi Arabia came over last week, within the last 2 weeks, and were trained in Washington by IRS agents about the science of financial forensics. And, the proof is in the pudding, of course, but we now have a commitment that we have a joint investigatory body with the power of compulsory process on the peninsula of Arabia, and I hope it will lead to personal accountability and criminal prosecutions. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I have actually two sort of unrelated questions. One is about, you said that two-thirds of the money cash flow is off. Well, what is that cash flow? Can you measure it? And secondly, I sort of tripped over something the other day. I was sort of surfing around the net and discovered that there is one of banks actually being set up here in this country, and this one firm that I came across has approvals in licenses in 6 states, and it's planning to do a lot more. And that particular founder of that particular company was highly suspicious to me, but that's another matter. they're saying in their conferences that the fall of Glass-Steagall is good for Islamic banking and it's going to advance Islamization in this country. So what's your reaction to that?
Well, I'm all for legitimate enterprise. This is not a war on Islam. It's not a war on Islamic banking. No one has a monopoly on commercial enterprise. And our target are essentially knowing bankers of terror, not religious affiliation at all. So if they want to establish the Islamic banking systems in the U.S., which sounds to me a bit of an anomaly, so be it. They'll subject to exacting levels of scrutiny by the OCC. It used to be part of my treasury job, New York State banking authorities, and wherever they're located, the state authorities there, and of course the Patriot Act, which is a pretty exacting and far-reaching act. So there's an irony. The more presence they have here, the more transparency there is of their operation.
Let's take a question from any press.
Remind me what it was.
I'm
not going to give you a number. I will tell you that estimate is a credible estimate, reasonable, but soft, because this is a soft calculus, but it's real. I can also tell you that the system of financing Al-Qaeda, which is still a very sophisticated system, has become very balkanized, very localized, and they raise money in localities also and don't frequently need transnational transported distributions. Mm-hmm.
Following that, I actually
wanted
to challenge your premise that cutting the funding of Google straight through an Al-Qaeda or booster networks that are quite balkanized and localized. And I want to bring up Turkey's office as an example. When you had four local guys who were, as the mastermind of Islamic, seemed to have some relationship to, they were trained in Afghanistan, granted that they were, nonetheless, they could easily raise funds locally, actually, and how expensive it is to buy trusted explosives. I understand that you need this international network for passports and whatnot, but not that much money is involved in the level of, transacting.
Well, actually, if you take a look at the footprint, while it might take a dollar to execute an act, the tranches that are transferred in support of that dollar and other dollars are much larger than that, and therefore more identifiable. That's point one. Point two is, you're right, there are an infinite number of ways for value transfer in the world today. Some of them ancient, some of them very modern. And we can't capture all of them. But to abdicate the attempt to create a safety net and to make it harder is certainly an invitation for more terror and more mayhem. This is doable because it's being done. We're making it harder for them to transfer and affect and execute crime on the basis of financial information and terror. Now, will we stop it all? No, we won't stop it all. Do we need more resources devoted to it? You bet. Even more intelligence resources should be devoted to this than have been devoted worldwide, so that we can anticipate and prevent rather than prosecute the exercise of terror. But the observation that it's hard, leading to the abdication of the effort to try, is simply an invitation for open mayhem. One last thing. The harder it is to transfer, it is also the easier for us to capture. That is, there's a higher profile for the tranches. Instead of 100 tranches, they come in a dozen tranches. Because this particular manner of transfer has been cut off, and that manner of transfer has been cut off. It's akin, if you want an analogy, if there's a border that stretches 2,500 miles and you have customs agents all along 2,400 miles of that border, sure, there's 100 miles that's open, but everything now has to flow across 100 miles if you want to smuggle. Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead. Two questions to ask, but let me just ask you something about the oil system program that still has bearing on the world today. It was set up in such a way Actually, there were dollars flowing at all points. We then were supposed to handle them.
Yeah.
And there was no transparency as far as details of any of the contracts. No. You could not see from outside what firms in Russia were selling the Mercedes. Who in Syria, Yemen, Sudan, and Saudi Arabia was supplying the powdered milk, what they were getting for it, the quantities, crucial details. What was, the U.S. was part of this scheme, our mission set on the Security Council, and made no fuss as the program became ever more outrageous. What is the rationale for keeping something like that so non-transparent? Question for being, the U.N. wants to be a nexus here. Is there a case to be made, and is anyone important in making it, that we should be able to see their accounts as well?
I don't think there's any argument against transparency. The first thing President Bush and Secretary Ben O'Neill did, I think it was March of 2003 when we came in, was try to make the sanctions program, the UN Oil for Food program, even smarter than it is, for many of the reasons that you've articulated. We were essentially stopped by the voting bloc in the UN from doing that. Our recourse, therefore, was not UN remedy, but beefed up, if you will, U.S. scrutiny of what might be going in there. And we did. We beefed up watching what might be going on.
Just follow up. Was there anything preventing us from losing the information we had? In other words, we were privy to whatever records the Security Council was privy to.
You know, Cody, I don't know the answer whether there was a legal proscript arising out of the UN Charter or not in the way it was written. I actually don't know the answer to that. Let me make sure you understand. I don't take truck with the ambition that I've just articulated, but my own view is that you really have to take a look at the war of terror and terrorist design as an attempt. Look, they're not trying to get our soil, okay? What they are trying to do is limit the extent and the exercise of our national and commercial power around the world. You know, there's a very interesting study done by the Center for Democracy and the Pew Group, which was released recently, of a poll taken in Islamic countries. You have a funny kind of contrast. The popular sentiment embraces our technology, our products, our movies, our entertainment, and our principles of democracy. Notwithstanding that, there seems to be widespread antipathy and downright condemnation of the way we've gone about the war on terror. There is almost uniform in 8 Muslim countries, uniform contempt and disagreement with our incursion into Afghanistan. And there is near similar disdain for our policies with regard to Israel. That to me is part of the support for my proposition that there really is no true geographic ambition to this loose-knit band of scoundrels right now, other than to, in the first instance, limit the exercise of U.S. and Western power. By the way, it should be plain to everybody, I hope it's intuitively correct to all of you. They're not trying to plant a flag anywhere, except in the world of ideas.
Assuming a very general proposition, a very general premise, which is repeated endlessly, assuming that the oil weapon is removed, all the West is self-sufficient, and that it can spin on only without the Middle Eastern oil. And would that remove any of this activity of funding for the terrorists, or would it mean anything?
You know, the question is almost beyond my ken. I'd just be speculating and it'd be just cocktail chatter. I will say, you know, the largest Muslim country in the world is not in the Middle East. So we have to keep our eye on the ball. This winning the hearts and minds of the common man in the Muslim world is a very important thing, and it's not all Middle East oriented.
You spoke briefly about the
Muslim
community in the Wallace.
Yeah.
Is that more of a black market
back
of cash,
not
a bank?
No. The best example I can give you, please don't. This is not for printing. This is just by way of educational, instructive example. Western Union is a Hawala, if you look at the generic definition of Hawala. If you have a kid in college like I do out in Palo Alto and he calls up and says, Dad, I need $100. In the old days, we used to go to Western Union and say, send my kid $100 and they charge me $1. Well, they don't actually transmit money from Washington, where I live, to Palo Alto. They call up their office in Palo Alto and say, young David Alvarez is going to show up, and his PIN number is 111. Give him $100 when he shows up. That's a hawala. To give you a more real sense, we have a lot of immigrants, particularly Pakistani immigrants, who drive cabs in Washington, D.C. They take a significant amount of their money every week and go to the 7-Eleven, where somebody behind the desk also operates as a hawaladar. And they say, please send money back to my brother in Karachi. And the fellow at the 7-Eleven says, how much do you want to send? $100. The system charges $95. He says, fine. So he gives $100 to the 7-Eleven clerk. 7-Eleven clerk gets on his on the internet and types a note to his brother. He says, Keith Alvarez is going to show up in Karachi tomorrow. His PIN number is 111. Give him 95. Give him 95. Now, at some juncture, the two ends of that Hawala deal, the Washington and the Karachi deal, get together and they settle their accounts in an aggregate way. They go to Geneva and have a good dinner. But that's how a Hawala deal, how a Hawala works. There's nothing unlawful, illicit, or illegal about it. Having said that, we've gone around the world and gotten most of the third world to adopt rules and regulations that require licensing, regulation, paper documenting. That's revolutionary in the Hawala world. And SAR requirements, that is, suspicious activity requirements. That's all very good, but as the finance minister of Pakistan said to me, David, that's wholesale. We got to go retail with this. Nobody in Pakistan, in a local bank or a Hawaladar, knows what's suspicious. We don't do transactions like you do in New York City. We got to give it definition and education. And, of course, finally, you have to enforce those new rules and regulations, which are revolutionary to the commercial population in many of these countries, and that requires the capacity building that I referred to earlier.
We have 1 minute left, so time for one quick question. So,
what's the magnitude of financing emanating from, say, countries like Syria and Iran, and how the rules of engagement for the intervention of funds change when dealing with both states?
Well, Iran and Syria are sponsor states of Hezbollah, by way of example. If you assume that Hezbollah has a perhaps a budget as high as $200 million. $100 million of it comes from Tehran. It's their fourth estate, in my judgment, and their fourth army. How do we deal with that? We try to capture that money as best we can in anticipation of its transfer. But it's very hard. Let me give you another example. I hope this isn't off the mark. The Hamas example. After six years, we finally got the European Union countries, some of the countries, to agree with us that it's sheer sophistry to distinguish between the military wing and the political wing. And this happened about 4 months ago. The day after they agreed with us and named Hamas as a sponsor of terrorism and put them on their watch list, we also presented these countries with the names of four public fundraising companies throughout Europe, including in England, very prominently, with radio ads and TV ads and internet sites, raising money for Hamas. And we asked them to freeze the assets and close these entities down. Not even England did that. We have to overcome yet still some lack of conviction abroad about how to address state-sponsored, if you are near state-sponsored, entities that have the patina of a political legitimacy, like Hezbollah does as a political party in Lebanon, standing for the Shia constituency in Lebanon.
This is sort of a follow-up to that. Naturally, just yesterday there was news that Belgium and the EU were making pacts, you know, the commercial pacts with Syria. So is that a concern, or is that another case where there's going to be more transparency, and so you're not worried about it?
Well, I come from the school that the more integration that Syria has with the Western world in terms of commerce, the more transparency and the more likelihood that we can bring them into the frame. It's, I think it's the proper way to try to reach out. Now, having said that, the last 6 months of my professional life were dealt, were spent dealing with the issue of Iraqi money that is or is not in Syria. And it has been a torturous set of negotiations.
I think that's all the time we have. But again, I'd like to thank Mr. Althauser for this excellent presentation.
Thanks.
How does Hezbollah send money to? How does Iran send money to Hezbollah?
Send it to Syria and then they carry it across the border and back.
Sorry.
Right.